With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom by simply visiting www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
You're listening to Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair with me, Jerry Pives. So a big welcome today to Matthew Tehuki. Welcome into the Psychotherapist Chair, Matthew. How are you?
Kia ora, Jerry. I'm happy to be here and nice and comfortable in the chair. Thank you.
And today we're going to be talking with Matthew and we're going to be finding out what makes him tick, what gets him out of bed in the morning, what's influenced him, how does he deal with stress and trauma, and hopefully lots of other stuff we can learn from him. So Matthew, not everyone may know about you. I've had the great privilege of attending one of your workshops, and I just want to say, how would you describe yourself and what you do to those listeners who've never heard of you before? How would you summarize what it is that you're doing with your life?
So I'm currently in Auckland in between festivals. I've just done a festival. I've got another one next week. So I'm a traveling musician at the moment, going to festivals and doing house concerts, bringing people together and using my music to reach their hearts and to get them moving, to help them release negative energy out of their bodies and to get them to think about things and feel things. So that's what I'm currently doing in this very moment. Where I'm at and within myself, I'm all about growing myself, continuing to grow myself into a better man constantly, daily, moment by moment. Looking after family, building stronger relationships around me. Looking forward to getting home and finally building a proper garden because I've been on tour all summer. So I'm looking forward to being out of this season of festivals and having a chance to settle down for a few months and get some good routines going on. Sorting out all the things at home. I'm a father of three and a grandfather of two. So one thing that really gets me out of bed at the moment is I have a seven-year-old who lives 15 minutes away with his mother, and he's a huge focus for me. He keeps me in the country at the moment. I used to travel quite a lot, but now I just want to be as available to him as possible. I've got a beautiful relationship with my partner that I'm building as well, and that definitely is a big part of my life. Sharing my workshops like the one you came to, I'm doing them online a lot at the moment, so that I can be in other countries and other parts of the world without having to deal with airport security, which I loathe. And developing this online course for men called Taniha, the Confident Loving Man, with an amazing woman called Lana Garland, so that we can get thousands of men through this course, so that we can have confident, loving men in our communities, in our families, in our society, to really help strengthen this planet. So those are the things that I'm currently focused on at the moment, and I'm happy to be in good health and good spirits. And when I'm sharing my work, I feel fulfilled and purposeful. And because I love doing that, I'm just constantly striving to get better and better at what I do so that my work, my medicine can be more and more effective. And that helps me go to bed at night and give me a good list of gratitudes to go through in my head or speaking them out loud before I go to sleep. That feels like a good summary.
Yeah, it's a lovely place for us to start. Now, just in case anyone who listens wants to chase up and find out more about you, Matthew, can they go to rainbowwarrior.co.nz? Is that the place to go?
Yeah, rainbowwarrior.nz. There's no co in there. So yeah, that's my website. Right. That's where I have most of my offerings. But my Taniha Confident Loving Man course isn't on there. But if you type in The Confident Loving Man, you should find that course online as well. It's a five-week online course.
Beautiful. You've got two grandchildren, you said?
So I have three sons. One's 29, one is 24, and one is 7. my 24-year-old, he's a musician as well. He's making great music. Nico Te Huki, he's got a band called Half Cast, and he's also got a solo thing called Casual Healing, and he's made two beautiful grandchildren. He's got one in his 1 year old and one is 2 years old, so they live close by. So I'm really enjoying that grandparent energy in my life at the moment.
Yeah, it's a powerful energy, eh?
It is. It's special. It's beautiful.
Maybe tell the listeners a little bit about what influenced you most in your growing up. What were the biggest influences in your life, would you say? Because this is a very, let me just reflect a little bit first. This is a very out there, in front of people, transformational, and probably very challenging, I imagine, type of work. As I say, I've experienced one of your live workshops, and you know, you hold a big group, you hold the space, you make it safe. That's not easy to do. That's a challenge for anyone being up there, out there. So what do you think made you strong enough and mad enough to put yourself out there like that?
It's a good question, because as a boy, I was painfully shy and I was very happy to blend in and not put my hand up and not stand up and not lead. I was very happy to play backing roles, and I would look back and say it was probably the Māori culture, the world of kapa haka, standing in a group, projecting my voice to make my group sound as loud and strong as possible, making myself as big and powerful as possible as a haka warrior when I was 13 and very skinny and very small. So I had to really inflate myself and make myself big and powerful, even though I was really shy. And then they would get me to, because I had a good singing voice, they'd get me to sing the trios or the duets or even the solos, and I'd be so painfully shy that I'd be crying while I was doing it. But gradually, over time, just seeing and feeling the responsibility of being in a group, I would push through and push through and push through the embarrassment and the shyness and the awkwardness, to the point where, yeah, it just naturally grew that I would step into those leadership roles, which included saying a speech of acknowledgement in between songs if that felt appropriate, which it quite often is in the Māori culture, is to use your voice to acknowledge people and to praise them and to thank them. And so I'd say the Māori culture was probably the turning point that took me from this shy boy that wouldn't speak up. And that included if I went into a shop and they gave me the wrong change, I wouldn't even question it. I was too shy to speak up for my rights, even like that. I'd say the Māori culture and watching my mum. My mum's this small non-Māori woman. She's Irish, Scottish, Italian, English woman, and she was just so tenacious when she was standing up for her rights, whether it was in a shop or in a meeting or anywhere. She was just, I would actually get embarrassed to be around her when she would speak up. I was embarrassed on her behalf because she wasn't. And that was really inspiring for me, even though it was full on, to witness someone standing up against assumed authority. So she was a big influence as well. If I look back,
she sounds a powerful person.
Mm.
And I think from what you told, I think you shared a bit about yourself on my workshop, and I think also with Natalie. And by the way, if any listeners want to hear a really wonderful discussion between Matthew and Natalie, do go and look that up on the RCR replays. You can listen to those anytime you want. And you discussed some really interesting things. But I think there you also talked about your background. Now, I'm learning as fast as I can about the importance of the Māori culture here in New Zealand. I came over 3 years ago. And although I was born in this land, I spent all my life after the age of four in England. So I only came back here 3 years ago. And interestingly, in terms of grandparents, I came because my only grandson was in New Zealand, and I was the only grandfather, the only grandparent who could get into New Zealand when the country was locked off from the rest of the world. So it pulled me out of everything I was doing. I had a business, I had a training company, I had a practice, everything. This grandfather, grandson energy pulled me back here, as did New Zealand itself. I've always felt New Zealand pulling me back from the age of four. It was like I felt pulled back all the time. I always resisted it until my grandson tipped the scale, and then nothing would stop me. And here I am, and here I stay. But now, one of the things that I am very envious of from the Maori side of life is this determination, wherever possible, to keep a connection with our roots, with Maori roots, with the ancestors. And I believe that when Maori meets Maori, they spend time checking out each other's history when they say hello to each other. And I wondered what you would want to say to me about your history, about your roots in both Maori and in your mother's side with the Irish and the Scots and all those cultures as well. What, in the Maori way of greeting, how does that work best? You know, what is the cultural way of getting to know someone?
Kia ora. So it's a big thing for us to know how we might be connected. So if I meet another Maori, we want to know where they come from and who they come from, so that we could potentially go back through our ancestral lines and find a connection somewhere. And if we can't do that, then we might find out where they live or where they come from, and maybe we knew someone there. And, you know, you meet some old Maori people, and they will just keep asking, do you know the paku whānau? Do you know the rimene whānau? And they'll just keep asking until I say, oh, yes, I know the haiata whānau. And they go, ah. And then we can talk about other things. So for us, we either do that in our face-to-face greeting, or we'll actually have our introduction circles where we'll go around and we'll say our mountain and our river and our canoes and our ancestors. And it is something that I've taken into modern day life, even with non-Māori, where we sit down and we in a group and we introduce ourselves. And I've added things like, what's your favorite color, or what's your biggest passion in life, so that we can start getting related and connected. So that's part of the Māori culture that I've always appreciated for building connection, and I've now brought that into modern day life in any group that I'm part of. I think it's really important that we take time before we get into the agenda, or before we get into the work as a group, that we get to know who we are with, and that can build a better connection so that the work can flow better.
In many ways, this program is all about that. It's all about our connections. It's also all about what the wonderful group of listeners we have might also connect with, who you and I can't see or hear at this moment, but they will hear and see us. Well, they won't see us, they'll hear us. Mm. Interestingly, that in my psychotherapy training back in the day, this would be back in 1994, I was so impressed in that psychotherapy training that we did training weekends, and the first hour and a half to 2 hours was spent not doing training. And at first I thought, well, this isn't good. I paid all this money to do all this training. Why are we just sitting around and saying how we feel and how we are? And of course, as I got more into the training, I realized that was so important. If we allowed ourselves to settle and to arrive and check in with each other, how people are, how they're feeling, what their week or month has been like, it amazed me how beautifully the training weekend would flow. And whenever I attended a training where people arrived and they got straight into it, straight into the task, straight into the learning, straight into whatever it was that people came together to do, all the personal stuff kept interfering all the way through. Like, it kind of got in the way of the whole training. Whereas to connect, to state where we are at the beginning, we call it checking in. And then in my psychotherapy training groups and in all my groups, we always do a checkout process. So if you have six sessions in a weekend, the first one is checking in and the last one is checking out. So now we've only got four sessions to do the content, but we would get through more in those four sessions than if I tried to start with the content in session one and keep going to the end. We would actually do more by establishing a kind of grounding and arriving. And as a body worker also, I find giving people time to arrive is so important. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I agree. As I said, it's part of our culture, and I like to bring that even into boardroom situations where we sit down and I need to know who I'm sitting with before I feel comfortable and relaxed to do the mahi, to do the work. And, you know, we have that as well. We have what we call poroaki, where we go around and we talk about how things were, and we don't just be nice about it. If things weren't working, we'll be upfront about it so that we can improve next time.
Love it. Really good. Really nice. So one question I sometimes like to ask is, why are you doing this? Why are you willing to come into the psychotherapist chair on the radio and talk with me about what kind of makes you tick? What motivates you to do this?
I'd say the first thing that motivates me to have this conversation with you today, Jerry, would be my respect for RCR, for the radio station, and what you guys are up to there. I'm a big fan of the radio station and the voice that it gives and the opportunity it gives for people to hear real voices, have reality check radio out there. So I'd say that would be the main motivation for me showing up today. And now that I'm here, I'm open to being open about how I got to be where I'm at, in the faith that it might inspire somebody, it might positively influence someone else in their life so that they can feel they're not alone in their journey and maybe be inspired by some of the paths, choices that I've taken in my own life so that I can support others to grow as smoothly as possible.
And I think there we already have one of the prime motivating factors of your life, because I know that creating gatherings, you said earlier on, creating gatherings, creating kind of community, creating a chance for people to get together, this really kind of, this matters to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I'm very happy and comfortable in my own company, and I know that it's important to spend time working on myself alone. But I think we need to do this work as community, with groups, with others, to really maximize the human experience for ourselves and to share what we're doing with others and to amplify it. Like, I could do my own work, but it's not until I get into a real solid, loving, intimate relationship with another, like my partner, that then all the triggers start happening, and then we can really work together. We can only do so much by ourselves. You know, I don't want to be a monk in a cave. I know that I could evolve and grow a lot like that, but I'm totally all about the human experience being a communal, collective experience. And I'm here for my growth, and I care about humanity. I care about this planet. So I'm aware that I need to play a bigger game than I thought I was going to play as a child. But I'm grateful that over the past few decades, I've gathered a lot of experience and skills that have supported me in the roles that I'm playing now and have played in the last few years to bring people together and to hopefully bring the best out of people.
Well, I'm a real addict of community, so I really respect and want to honor your work, and I want to honor what you do in the way that you bring people together, Matthew. I think community is not only important now, but it's going to become so important as we progress through the next decade or several decades potentially. I think people who create community have a particular role to play in the future, and I think that's why I wanted to interview you, because I saw in your work something that I recognized, which was this bringing together of people. Not just in training, but through song and music, and I think through food and dance and all the sort of communal communal things that bring humans into something. When I work with people, I think of there's the person I'm with, there's me, but there's also what we create together, almost like a third entity, like in this session here right now. Neither you nor I are going to walk away with just Matthew or just Jerry. We're going to walk away with an experience shared, which I hope will be a good one for you, but which is different from either you or me. So it's almost like there's a third person present, something we create.
Yep, and I just want to acknowledge that sometimes you need to go without something to really appreciate that what you have. And, you know, I'm grateful for the longing and yearning that was created by the lockdowns, how we were separated from each other and we were forbidden to gather and be amongst each other's company. So as soon as those gates opened, I've pretty much been nonstop making the most of the opportunities that we do have now together and bring people together. So I'm feeling the desire to do it more than I was a few years ago, thanks to that.
Yeah, right with you on that. So tell us a little bit, Matthew, about your experiences when you were younger.
So growing up, I had two older brothers and mum and dad. We lived together, and I feel grateful, especially going through life and hearing about other people's childhoods. I feel grateful for the solid, safe environment that I grew up in, and lots of nurturing, especially from my mum. Dad was this solid pillar that didn't talk much and was at work all day, and sort of held this authority in the house, this non-questionable authority. So I just want to acknowledge that I'm feeling really grateful for the pretty sweet upbringing that I had. Went off to Catholic schools and was around that sort of vibe until I left school. I look back and I think being involved in the Māori culture really, really worked for me. Mum and Dad joined a kapa haka group as adults when we were little kids, and Mum was non-Māori. She was the only white woman in that scene, and Dad was Māori, very dark skinned, but didn't know any language or any culture because his father was punished for speaking it as a child. But they took us into that scene, so we would hang out at the marae and we would have their kapa haka group come and hang out at our house and sing the songs, and we'd go to sleep sometimes with the guitars playing in the background and the happiness of the waiata. And there was a pride that we had in being part of those situations, and that was a big part of my upbringing. And being quite boyish, there were the three boys in our house, and there was three Māori boys in the house next door, the only Māori family in that part of town, it seemed. So lots of boisterous boy playing and mischief and rough and tough stuff going on there, and I was the youngest, so I had to learn how to look after myself. And then, of course, when I went off to the Māori boys' boarding school, super skinny, super shy, once again learning who to get cheeky to and who not to get cheeky to and how to look after my gears. And then, of course, you know, stepping into my power as a speaker and a singer. And then I started getting bigger, which was good because we had to play rugby and I didn't like it because I was skinny and scared of tackling people. And then I grew into my body, and then I got into that physical aggressive sport, which I continued to play well into my 30s. I actually switched to rugby league because it was even more physical and more aggressive, and that really served me as well. But I just went beyond my childhood. But it was a sweet childhood, and one thing that really stands out was my mum would find opportunities for me to extend myself. She would take me to auditions for the local choir. She would take me to guitar lessons. She took me to an audition for the New Zealand haka group that was going to go and travel to Spain and perform at the World Expo. And I was dead against it because I was only like 18. I was skinny and insecure. And there was all these big monster warrior men that were in the national groups that were auditioning. But she took me, and I was a little brat, grumpy there, grumpy all the way back. Next minute I'm flying to Spain and I'm getting paid really well to do haka 5 times a day and explore the other side of the planet. And that was a big game changer for me, because up until then, all I knew was Masterton and Greymouth. And all of a sudden, I'm getting paid to be a Māori performer. And that was a huge paradigm shift for me, opened my eyes to how appreciated the Māori culture was, especially out of this country. And it created a deep desire to travel and share my culture and to be believing in what I had to share. And when I got back, I was working in the sawmill, and that was really killing my soul. And then I looked into my basket of knowledge, and I realized that I had kapa haka, and I've been a kapa haka and Māori language teacher ever since in my early 20s. So looking back, my mum was instrumental and influential in my path that I'm on now, because of those little turning points that she put me in, believing in me, backing me, driving me across town on those nights after working all day, and just backing me all the way. So much respect to my mum and that solid, silent pillar that is my dad, who only came to my first gig a couple of years ago and finally told me he was proud of what I was doing. I think he struggled to understand that you could make a living without working hard day after day in a 9-to-5 job. So yeah, much respect to mum and dad for helping me get to where I am now, especially for being such great parents.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm just thinking of the enormous gift and influence of a powerful woman, and what sounds like a very steady dad, very, very solid. And what you touched on there, I think, is one of the great wounds of New Zealand society, which is that your father, and I believe his parents, you said, were punished for speaking te reo. Is that right?
Yeah, my grandfather's generation was punished. My father's generation missed out completely, because his father didn't want him to get in trouble. And at that stage, there was like, why do we need the language? Why do we need the culture? So that's when it was almost gone. It wasn't until the 80s that it started coming back.
And how old are you now, Matthew?
I'm 51.
So when you went to the Māori boys boarding school, where is that, by the way? I don't know where that is. What is that? Are there many of those, or is there just one in New Zealand?
There was a handful. I think there's only a couple left. This one is called Hatopaura Māori Boys College, St. Paul's, and that is around Fielding out in the countryside.
So presumably that's where you learned to speak te reo, is that right?
It was during those schooling hours that I learned, but also in my school holidays I would go to these hui rangatahi, which was gatherings for young people on different marae in the Horo Whenua Manawatū area. And I went there predominantly in those days because there were girls there. And when I was at boarding school, it was only boys, and I was really missing girls. I was a bloody teenager with no girls around, so I would go and spend a whole 5 days sleeping in the same meeting house as all these girls, and that was the draw card. But when I was there, I learned the language and the songs and the protocols and the culture, and it worked out well. And I would go to those gatherings until I actually grew to the stage where I was going with the adults to Reo Rumaki, which is total immersion gatherings, which would go for about a whole week where we only spoke the Māori language. And I would go to those with my mother, and she was learning the language alongside me, even though she was a lot slower at picking it up. But she would get me there, and we'd hang out, and we'd come back. So much respect to her. There was another area that she really supported me.
It sounded like she was really, it really mattered to her that you should know all your roots, not just your European roots, but your Māori roots.
Yes, I think she might have seen where our dad was at for not having it, and she was the one that said our boys are going to learn how to be Māori. And saying that, it was the Māori culture she pushed and the Italian culture. She didn't spend much time talking about the Irish or the Scottish. She's always flown the Italian flag really strongly. That's the one that she's pushed on us.
Oh, cool. And how much immersion have you managed to have with that Italian, those Italian roots of yours?
Well, luckily, I was married to an Italian woman for quite a few years, and she is the mother of my 7-year-old, and she only speaks Italian to him. So my it's okay. I can understand quite a bit.
Awesome, awesome country, awesome language, awesome culture. I think Italy is one of my favorite places to go to.
Yeah, they're a hard case over there. I do love the way they eat and do family, though.
Yeah, and that brings us right back, doesn't it, to the importance of community, the importance of family. And by that, I don't just mean the nuclear family, I mean the extended family. There's not many teenage boys who get the opportunity to spend nights in the same hall with a bunch of girls, eh? That must have been really quite exciting.
Oh, yeah. There was. And then I'd go back to boarding school for another couple months with no girls around, and I'd look forward to the next one. Oh, the motivations, eh?
Yeah. If you're listening to Reality Check Radio, and this is Real People, and we're talking to Matiu Tehuki, and we're talking about his roots and his, particularly his cultural roots, both in his Italian and European roots, but also, most importantly, I think, being able to reclaim his Maori culture, his Maori roots, after a very common wounding that went on here in New Zealand, where his grandparents were punished for speaking the language of their family, the language of their ancestors. And his own father grew up, I think, not speaking Te Reo. Is that right? Or did he have to learn it? How did your father manage when he was being brought up by parents who had been punished for speaking their own language?
I feel like my dad was just growing up, learning how to be a Kiwi, then getting by with his English language and getting into work and getting through it. He didn't start speaking until he was in that Maori culture group, or speaking as in just the odd words. He didn't speak much Maori around us because he didn't have much to speak, but he was singing a lot of Maori songs, and I think that was really good for his heart, good for his spirit. Yeah, but not much language. He didn't pick up. It was my mum that did most of the learning around the language and speaking of it.
I've met several people who have told me that despite being of Maori descent, they had to go and learn Maori because they grew up initially speaking English. And this is a big story in New Zealand, I think. What do you think about this?
Yeah, the great thing is that it's available and it's accessible. So even after my high school years, I actually stopped learning the Maori language. I had some in my basket, enough to speak it pretty well and enough to actually go out and teach it to children and to beginners. But that got me by for a couple of decades. And then I think it was when I was around 40 that I went back to Te Whare Wānanga o Aotearoa, and I started learning again and started upgrading because I was getting by, but I wanted to learn more. And it's a continual thing. I'm continuing to learn more songs, especially in the songs. That's one of my favorite ways of learning in the waiata, because I also want to step more and more into my leadership. And as our Māori elders are dying off, I want to have more and more understanding of the protocols and the customs and things like that. So it's a constant journey for us, especially if we're not brought up with it in the house. And I look at our brothers and sisters from our Pacific Islands, and I'm really happy for them that they grow up. Most of them still have their language in their homes, but the Maori, we lost it, except for a couple little pockets in the country that have stayed strong with their language all the way through. So it's a thing, you know. You got to keep looking for it. You got to keep searching and keep doing the work if you want to grow. But luckily, there's so many more resources around than there were in the past, so it's available. It's just about your desire for it.
And there's even more to this because your work, I know, is about bringing the wisdom and the power and the value of the Maori culture to other Kiwis of different cultures and sharing the wisdom of that culture. And having been on a workshop with you, it felt very generous. It felt very open. And it felt like you were able to share this beautiful culture without feeling that in some way you were demeaning it in any way. I just wondered how it's been for you, because you're generous, man. You share it, and you bring the wisdom that you've learned about the Maori culture, and you apply it across to all people, all New Zealanders. And I think now with your Taneha work, your men's work, I think you're taking it globally. Am I correct?
Yeah, not just the Taneha course, but also my workshops. I'm now zooming into different parts of the world as well. Yeah, so I grew up at a time where, like my mum, there were lots of gatekeepers, because I believe first and foremost that our Indigenous cultures have so much healing wisdom for our planet right now, and that includes the Maori culture. Luckily, we retained a lot of our wisdom. A lot of cultures had so much wiped out, and because so much was taken and buried, and so much was taken and used, a lot of Maori and a lot of other Indigenous cultures have held on tightly to what remained, because they had so much stolen and pillaged and taken away from them and buried and lost. So I understood that, and I grew up watching my mum go to learn, and there were people saying, you're not allowed to learn this, this is not your culture. So I grew up seeing it being held on and not shared, but I also saw it being shared at the same time to non-Maori. So first of all, I believe in the healing powers of the wisdom, of the stories, of the protocols, of the ways of being, of practices like haka. And because I grew up watching non-Maori learn alongside me, it just makes sense that this gets shared. And I've been very generous and welcoming for people to come into my work and feel welcome and to have a place, especially when I look at our genealogies. I think we're all connected way back. And because the Maori navigated and sailed around, our ancestors were traveling all around the Pacific and connections. Like, I did a workshop and I was zoomed into a hall in Cairo, Egypt the other day, and I'm standing there, I'm on this huge screen on a wall, and I've got a speaker there, and I'm talking to these people and acknowledging we have the same sun god. Ra is our sun god, Ra is their sun god. Straight away we just went, oh, cuz, let's do the work. And they wanted to haka, because they wanted to use haka to release all of the stress and frustration and anger and anguish, because their cousins on their border are being smashed at the moment because of Palestine. So I was able to zoom in and share a common culture between us to support them in their nervous system and support them in their hearts and their spirits and their minds right now through haka. And then the next day I was off to Sweden, and I was doing one in Sweden. We don't have the same sun god, but we're all human beings, and we all have negative emotions that we need to get out of our body. And haka is one of the most powerful tools that I've come across to release frustration, anxiety, fear, anger, and to build up courage and strength and not being pushed around. So yeah, I'm a big fan of sharing, especially because I've watched it not being shared. And I feel like I've learned enough to be a good ambassador for the culture and to make sure that I can do it correctly. And I make sure that if I'm teaching anyone else one-on-one how to be a good haka leader so that they can teach their community, I always make sure that I push them to the point where they are ready to learn, to the point where they can share. So yeah, our Indigenous culture's got so much wisdom. We need it right now. So who am I to hold it back, especially if I see it as such a healing tool for people?
Wonderful. Beautiful. One of the wisdoms of so many cultures, but the Maori culture, I believe, embedded in that haka is embodiment. You know, the fact is we live in these bodies, and that's a reality that is part of who we are. And I think about how cerebral much of Western European culture, how much of academic culture has become, And I think of the importance of embodiment, and what you're talking about is that release, that discharge out of the body of trauma. I wonder if you can say any more about that.
Well, you know, at times like this, there's so much stress in people's bodies. There's so much fear in our communities. There's a lot of anxiety building. Mental health is, you know, mental health issues are growing. So, yeah, we need to get in. As I said, haka is a way of getting into our bodies and releasing it through this energy, releasing it. But because one of the gems of haka is you got to slow it down. And when you're doing haka, you got all this fire and adrenaline and power, especially if you're actually doing it to someone for a reason, whether it's on the steps of Parliament protesting or whether it's honoring someone at a wedding. The passion is real, and it's really hard to slow down when you're fired up like that. So it teaches you control, teaches you self-control, teaches you willpower to rein that in, and so it allows you to release all the negative stuff, especially if you got your feet on the earth. But it allows you, like, I will do a haka if I'm feeling lousy, if I'm feeling stressed or something bad's happened, I will haka. But I also, if I'm about to have a job interview or if I'm about to have a conversation with someone and I know there's potential conflict between us or real conflict, I will haka to release all my potentially triggered energy so that I don't explode and say things that I might regret. But so I've released that so they can say whatever and I'm not going to react, but I'm also not going to be pushed around because I've got my backbone strong and I'm believing in myself and I'm this rock. And but I can do it calmly and I can do it gently and with respect so that we both leave that conversation with our mana intact. So it's such a physical experience when we use our bodies in such a way, and especially around this whole thing of not being pushed around, not being told what to do right now. Haka, I find, is a really good way of finding that unshakable, unapologetic energy, especially the not needing to be nice and say what you think others want to hear you say. Haka gives you permission to be a badass, and it gives us permission to actually piss some people off if what you're going to say is not going to be liked by them. I'm okay with that. I'm very clear that if I speak in public, some people are going to go, yeah, I'm with you. And some people are going to go, this is outrageous. How dare you speak such things? And I'll just go straight up the guts and do it with as much grace. And, you know, I'm training myself more and more to have my words land as lovingly and sweetly as possible while not giving a f*** at the same time if I piss people off. So that's the balance that I'm working on. I think it's important that we all look at that.
I'm really laughing at this because I can just imagine several listeners, many listeners, with a broad grin on their face with you describing that combination of grace and, I think, kindness, if we can use that word anymore. It's been massively abused, that word, but grace and genuine kindness, but also standing your ground. Holding your line, like Wellington did. The images of the haka at Wellington were awesome, and they were so inspiring. They expressed something that no amount of protesting, I believe, could ever express. There was something unique to that voice in that haka, and I know there are many hakas, but isn't that just the great challenge right now? Is to find grace and wisdom, but not allow ourselves to be pushed around anymore.
Yeah, and also for me, one of my challenges at the moment is to speak to everybody in front of me and find words that can unify us, regardless of what end of the spectrum we're sitting on with our beliefs on things. So that's something that I worked on because at the beginning of the lockdowns, I was very, f*** this is not good, these people are doing this, blah, blah, blah. And it was quite finger pointing and it was quite divisive. And that's how I felt I needed to be at the time. I was quite urgent, but now that we've come through the other side of that, my words are now trying to rebuild those connections between the believers in Jacinda and the haters of Jacinda, or the people that believe the jab is good and the people that know it's not, and trying to find words that can bridge between all of those groups and finding truth as a bridge. You know, it's one great thing at the moment is there's no denying that there are adverse reactions to this jab. You can't deny that. The truth is there, the proof is there. So I'm doing my best to find truths that are irrefutable and delivering them in ways, poetic ways, musical, melodic ways that people can actually absorb without being repulsed if it's not in line with what they're believing or being told to believe. So that's one of my current projects in life, is finding choice words to bring people together no matter where we're at, because this is an opportunity we have now to bring people together before the next wave of whatever comes down the tracks.
Well, we've all shared in one big trauma, haven't we? And we know from trauma that trauma can separate, like partners, couples, parents who suffer the trauma of, for example, a child dying. It can either drive the relationship apart, or it can bond people really tightly. And you're talking about how we can draw together after what has happened. And if anything is going to work for moving forward, it's going to be this concept you speak of unity, of bringing us together. And on this program, there's been a lot of discussion with previous people I've interviewed and with letters in. And by the way, you know, you're listening to Reality Check Radio. I'm Jerry Pives, and this is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And I'm talking to Mathieu Tehuki. And you can write in. Tell us what you think. Text in on 2057 2057. Or send me an email at inbox@realitycheck.radio. I'll read out what you have to say. And if you don't agree with me, write in. And if you do agree with me, write in. If you like the show, write in. If you don't like the show, write in. For heaven's sake, keep writing to me. I love all your messages. I just love them. And I'm always thinking of the listeners that write in when we do these interviews, Mathieu, because they kind of communicate themselves to me. We're talking about bringing people back together after so much division has been encouraged between New Zealanders and all across the world. And in fact, a great deal of what we've been talking about is bringing together, because we've been talking about the bringing together of you with your Māori culture, the bringing together of me understanding your culture as different from mine. These are the themes that are running behind this conversation, I sense. And this idea of bringing together is what's emerging in this conversation. And I want to ask you, what has been the worst trauma that you've been through, and how did you come through that? And was there anything about coming together in that? Or even if there wasn't, how did you get through that?
I would say, due to the blessed life I've had, I would say the lockdown chapter of the planet would be the biggest trauma I've experienced. It's probably the one that shook me the most, especially bringing up fear of where things were going and what could happen next. And there were times where the fear and the anxiety was so strong that I was really unsettled in my body. I would say plunging in cold water was always a quick way to wake myself up and get back into my body and get out of that. Playing music, was another one. Haka was always a safe one for me to head off to. I remember there was a time where I was so stressed that me and my brother were sitting there, and we must have watched too much news that day, and I was really, what are we going to do? We actually found a video on YouTube of a woman who was growing cucumbers. She's Chinese, and she just was going through the process of growing them, preparing them, feeding them to her grandmother. And it was the most soothing thing that I could think of at that time. There was just gentle music. There was no talk. And I could just feel my nervous system settle by doing this. And I was just reaching, what can I do? I'd done my haka, I'd done my shaking. Shaking's another thing that I do when I need to release. I have a good shake on the earth, feet on the earth. And then I think the other thing would be take some action. And that's when I would start. I had these weekly shows that I would do from my couch at home. I called it the Couch of Truth and Vulnerability. And the show was called Tiki Tiki Tuesday Tune Up, where I would talk about an issue. I'd talk about how do we look after our immune system during these times. This is when we're right in the lockdown. And then I'd sing a song about it. And then I'd come back to the couch and I'd talk about, I was just sharing ways that people could support their well-being in that time. So I think that was another thing. I just felt like I had to do something for the people out there. And that's how I was processing all that stress and all that fear and anguish at the time, was using what I had in my basket as a way of reaching out and bringing people together online in a little group or a big group. So community was another way of doing it, and unifying people and bringing joy, you know, trying to be light and funny and sing some songs.
It's making me think about, in psychotherapy, there's, you know, quite a long tradition of just saying, well, if you're feeling a bit, you know, bad, it's because there's something wrong with you, and we got to shrink your head. You know, we got to do some stuff on you. And then in the 1960s and 1970s, a branch of psychiatry or psychotherapy emerged called radical psychiatry. And this radical idea was that actually you're not operating in isolation. We're all influenced by what's going on around us. We cannot solve these problems alone. And within that, a key feature of people regaining their mental health was regaining their power. And so an integral part of radical psychiatry was the clients and the therapists as well taking social action to put right the wrongs that lead to depression or people being denied their basic human rights. So action is a really important feature. And I know that when I found myself here in New Zealand, many of the listeners know that very soon I stepped up and became a Voices for Freedom coordinator down here in Wanaka, and spent, well, it was 24/7 for about a year. But it was all action. It was all doing things that honored the people that had been abused, cancelled, discriminated against because of their health choices. And I felt it like a calling, like I felt when I came here for my grandson. That was a calling, something physical, but also when the whole lockdown thing emerged and the mandates emerged and all of that, I just felt I didn't really have a choice. I had to take action. And there was a great deal of release of energy in that action and taking action together with other people. And it's so important, isn't it? Action. And I think when you talk about the haka, you're talking about action, aren't you?
Yeah. Because we don't like to feel powerless. So finding a way to take action is so healthy for us. And for me, it's teaching haka or doing haka myself. But for some people, it might be painting, or it might be, we've all got our own strengths. So I think it's important that we look at it into our baskets of wisdom and skills and find what our strengths are at these times. And some people might be growing vegetables and then bringing people together to swap vegetables or to share food. So I think it's an important time to find what our strengths are and to maximize them and to strengthen our strengths.
So what do you think, Matthew Tehuki, what do you think gets you out of bed in the morning?
My big push at the moment is to have my offerings be as accessible to as many people as possible. That's what I'm driving at the moment. You know, I have different offerings, whether it's my one-on-one coaching that includes haka, or whether it's my workshops, or whether it's my musical gatherings, or even I have a hugging business where I create an hour of masculine safe hugging for women that just want to be held. So I've got all these different offerings. So I have all this love to give. I have all this medicine to share. So what gets me out of bed is, oh, I need to reach more people. I need to reach more people. That's what gets me out of bed. So I just feel like I'm this vessel that's ready to share. I'd love to just have a center where people were just flooding in to come in every day and I could share all these offerings.
I figure if a few more of us join in that dream with you and picture you in that place, in that center, full of people coming to you, I figure we can all help make that happen for you. I want to bless you from the bottom of my heart for your generous sharing, your determination to share and help and bring people into their power, into their strength. I just get such a strong feeling of all the goodness that you bring in your work, Matthew. And I just want you to know, you know, to wish you all the very best in your journey.
Kia ora, Jerry. It's been a privilege to have a chat with you and to have an opportunity to share with the people out there listening. So greetings to you if you're listening out there. But also want to acknowledge you, Jerry, for not just doing an interview, but for the fact that you're using your skills and your strengths to really support people in their lives at the moment. So it's been a pleasure talking with you. Kia ora.
Well, what an interesting story and what an interesting life. They say every life is worth a book, and that's what this program is showing over and over again. And what can we reflect? What can we learn from the story of Matthew's life? Matthew's life is really also the story of New Zealand, isn't it? Mother coming from Irish, Scottish, European, Italian roots, father Maori. There you have it. Matthew, in many ways, is like the embodiment of so much that makes up New Zealand. And what a story he's told in his life. The story of a boy whose grandfather was punished for speaking his own language. A boy whose father grew up not knowing how to speak his own language, his cultural roots, his family's language, his tribe's language. And then this resurrection, where did that come from? Well, just like we saw with our previous guest, Sue Gray, we saw the power of the mother. In Sue Gray's case, a mother who had been passed over for a brother, so she had no education, no support to be educated, and ends up raising a true boffin, if Sue doesn't mind me calling her that, bright as a spark and willing to use it in the service of Kiwis, traveling all over New Zealand to fight the causes and support those people who are being done badly to by corrupt governments and corrupt corporations. And here with Matthew's family, we see again the power of the mother, a mother that herself chose to embrace the Maori heritage of both her husband and her son, determined that not only her family should not lose the depth and cultural roots, but there's a fight for the whole of New Zealand. Do we have to destroy one culture so another can live? Or is there space and possibility and power even in cultures sharing, showing wonder and intrigue and curiosity at the wisdom in each. So any women, any mothers listening to this, never underestimate your power to inspire, your power to make change. One family that in some ways could be regarded as a microcosm of New Zealand. And you see, Matthew's life isn't just about reclaiming his Māori heritage. It's much, much more than that. It's about reclaiming it and then sharing it. I'm one person who he shared it with. And I was enriched by my first day learning Haka. So much wisdom and power, so much knowledge, so much human understanding that can pass from the Māori to the Kiwis of European descent. More than that, Matthew's life story has been a journey turning from a shy and nervous boy who would rather just blend in to the background, learning to find his voice, learning to find his mana, learning to find his power, being encouraged by the elders of his tribe to do so, and look at what that has produced. We already heard that he took New Zealand culture to Spain. We heard about Egypt. We heard about Japan. We heard about Sweden. This man is impressing the world with our culture. All New Zealanders should be proud of their heritage, whether that's European or it's Māori or it's Pacifica. What an amazing nation we are. But what we should be most proud of is celebrating all of those cultures, respecting each other, learning from each other, and sharing the wisdoms of each. And it is true that for all the wonders of Western civilization, all the amazing gifts of science and technology and farming and all the remarkable arts and culture that goes with Western civilization, we surely need the voice of the Māori culture, most specifically in the role of movement and dance and embodiment. There's wisdom in all of these things. It's not primitive to dance and sing. It's critical. It's essential for us as humans. And the need for us to reclaim our family's history and our extended families, and more than anything, our communities, to get together and eat together, to sing together, to dance together. This is what the Māori can bring. And they were in those European traditions as well. The Irish and the Scottish particularly have tremendous traditions of dance and poetry and the role of the arts. This is what humanity is. And this is what I take as my reflection from Matthew. He's an ambassador. I hope he becomes a national leader. I hope he's made ambassador, an ambassador for New Zealand. He already is doing it. The fact is, shouldn't we recognize people like that? And almost every single person that's come on this show has felt to me like a statesman, an elder, a leader. But that's not what you have to be to come onto this particular program. If you know anyone who puts themselves out for their local community, someone who serves others, I'm not talking about their jobs, but a Kiwi, maybe they're not even in New Zealand right now, who's doing something above and beyond what serves their own income or their own interest, someone who is serving people other than themselves. So if you know any of these unsung heroes, hidden gems, then nominate them and I'll send them an email invitation. They can ignore it. It's fine. I won't say who nominated them. I'll just say a fellow Kiwi has nominated you. I'd like to invite you. I have written a lovely email that explains what goes on the show, and I've said it's absolutely fine to say no, even if you are a Kiwi. This is a chance where you are okay to say no. And it's not rude, and it won't upset me, and I'll be far happier for you to say no than to come on and resent it. Not that that's happened. So all you have to do is think of someone who you think has truly served, not someone who the government appoints to give lots of money and to tell lies and cheat on their citizens. I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about the real politicians, the real people in our communities, the people who look after and serve and give voice for those without voice. So send me their name, send me their email address, because it won't work without, and tell me why you nominated them for real people. Now, you can text that to 2057 or send it in an email to inbox@realitycheck.radio and just put for Jerry. So in these reflections, I want to talk a little bit more about the role of action. I was going to do a whole talk about radical psychiatry and about the value of taking action and the role that action plays. It was a very good talk. But I was far more interested, once I started, in talking about us and talking about Matthew's life as a representation of the truly creative power that we have right here in New Zealand. As cultures come together, they don't have to collide and clash and fight. They should just enrich each other. But I will say a little thing about action, because it's kind of interesting that last week we had Sue Gray on. And if those of you that were at Wellington will know that Sue Gray spoke out very eloquently. She said the words and she spoke out and she challenged the government and gave voice to the thoughts and feelings of so many people at that protest. And I don't know whether you're aware, but at a really critical time on the second day of the protest, when the police started moving in, it was quite scary. No one quite knew how to handle that. We do now, but at the time we were trying to work it out. And Matthew stood up and grabbed a microphone and he started singing to everyone, including the police. And I've heard so many reports and I've seen on film the impact him standing up and singing a song could have. What a leader. He calmed everyone. I think he calmed the police as well. And one of the reasons I know this is because next week's guest made a film of it. Next week's guest is Alistair Harding. He was at Wellington interviewing people and he put together the most wonderful film, We Came Here for Freedom. And if you are listening and you haven't seen that film, then switch off your phone or your whatever you're listening to this on and just go and get it. You can get that film online. But I suspect many, many of the listeners of this radio station have seen this film and, like me, cried as we watched. So action is kind of here. It's right with us right now. Sue Gray stood up, took action, spoke words at Wellington. Matthew stood up, sang songs, changed the energy of the crowd. Alistair stood up and probably spent months putting together that film. This is all about action. And I suspect many listeners have all done enormous amounts. And I'd love to interview you, if only some of your friends would notice and nominate you. You can't self-nominate on this show, and it's not Jerry's Mates. I don't nominate anyone. I did the first three or four. But after that, the only people I'm interviewing are people that have been nominated by someone else. And I invite you to look around your own community. It's about time that the hidden gems and unsung heroes of every community get nominated, get to speak out their thoughts and share with us their wisdom. And what a lot of wisdom we get. And one of the wisdoms is the power of action. The thing about action is that It's the centerpiece of healing within something called radical psychiatry. Radical psychiatry moved away from conventional psychiatry because radical psychiatry said, well, we don't think it is just about the individual. We don't think there is anything wrong with people who are struggling. There's nothing wrong with their brain. They weren't made wrong. Nothing wrong with the chemistry. By the way, they still haven't proven any chemical difference between a healthy person and a mentally ill person. But the psychiatric mantra is chemical imbalance in the brain, for which there's absolutely no evidence. I think we've heard that a few times now, beginning to become a mantra all of its own. Here we go again. Nor is it about some suppressed sexual urges that you're supposed to have had when you were 5 or 6 years old. Go figure. What kind of madman makes up a theory like that? You might as well say that mental illness is caused by flying pigs. Radical psychiatry said, we are part of a society, a community, a country, and our mental health is very much determined by the environment we're living in. A bit like terrain theory in terms of medical disease. We're moving away from the absolute fraud of the germ theory and rediscovering what was known about before the pharmaceutical takeover of medicine, terrain theory. If you want to find out more about that, go look up the work of Antoine Béchamp, B-E-C-H-A-M-P. And there's a very interesting book, not so easily readable, I have to say, but if you're interested, and I was, and it kept me reading through, you know, quite a, I would have called it a slightly difficult read, but great information. Then there's a book by Ethel Hume called Béchamp or Pasteur, A Lost Chapter in the History of Biology. And that tells the story of the beginning of the corrupt practice, which led us down the road of germ theory and took us away from the far more truthful situation of terrain theory. The truth is, viruses are produced by the body as a result of an internal cleansing. But do your own research on that. That's another subject. But where was I? I was talking about the terrain of our environment. And the truth of the matter is, radical psychiatry realized that we are very much made sick by our environments. You've only got to look at the explosion in mental health problems in the last 3 years and suicides to see the obvious truth of that one. And what they saw was that most mental illness is the result of power, oppression by power. And the main technique utilized by those in power, according to radical psychiatry, is alienating people. Alienating people from themselves, from their heart, to produce loveless lives. Alienating them from their ability to think clearly, producing mindless lives or moronic lives. Alienating them from any sense of their own body's intuition or from their body's sensations and truth, producing joyless lives, because they're disconnected from their feelings. Radical psychiatry also moves on to say that we get alienated from our hands, from our work, producing jobless lives. And they also say that corrupt power brokers aim to alienate us from land and nature, to disconnect us from one of the most powerful sources of healing, which is nature, and producing landless lives. And they had an equation for mental health, mental illness, which was that oppression plus mystification plus isolation equals alienation equals sickness. Well, oppression, I don't think I need to say anything about these days. 5 years ago, I would have had to explain it. But just think of the control of movement of populations. Think about control of what they wear in terms of masks. Think about control through surveillance. I wonder if you heard Jordan Peterson discussing 700 million face recognition cameras in China alone. Government oppression, sinister, tyrannical oppression. Makes me sick just to talk about it. The second one is oppression plus mystification. Well, the word's a bit odd, but I think we all know it now. To create confusion. Use language that is confusing. Put together absolute opposites of meaning. Hi, guys, this is social distancing. Distancing and social in the same phrase? Ah, we're the single source of truth. Single source of truth? Not many claim to have that. And one of them was Jesus Christ. Is that what she's saying? Is she standing in his place? He kind of had to prove it by coming back from the dead. Maybe that's what we should ask her to do. And just for the record, I'm not suggesting that anyone commits any harm towards Jacinda. I think just leaving her to live with herself would be punishment enough. So mystification means confusing everyone. We call it gaslighting. George Orwell called it doublethink. Teams of psychologists are employed by the government not only to confuse people, not only to uproot words from their original meaning by putting them with words that mean the opposite, destabilize people, make them dizzy, but also to put fear into them and gaslight them. Oppression, surveillance, control of movements, plus mystification, language, confusion, and isolation. Don't need to say much more about that. Now, remember, this equation was put together in 1960. Alienation equals oppression plus mystification and isolation. That's mental illness. But where does action come into all of this? Well, we're getting there. In fact, we've got there. We're here right now. The cure, which is mental health, the opposite of alienation, is liberation. And liberation involves three things. Just as alienation had oppression, mystification, isolation, liberation has awareness, action, and contact. Radical psychiatry aims to find out information, to become aware of what the social forces are, to make sure that we get information from many sources, to do our own inquiry and our own research. Nota bene, do not rely on the bloody experts ever again. Awareness. See what's going on. Yes, I know it's scary, but better to be aware than asleep. You're not really alive otherwise. And with awareness comes the other one, contact. Be with other humans. Join together. Eat kai together. Dance together. Sing together. We heard that a bit today. And take action. Do something that puts right or wrong in your local community. Join with others. Don't do that alone, but join with a local group. And if you want a book to read that's a lot easier to read than Ethel Hume's book, but I still recommend Ethel Hume's book, by the way. And there's another book on that, just come out by Drs. Mark and Sam Bailey, called The Final Pandemic. Check out the interview that they had with Rodney Hyde. I think it's the best interview I've ever heard about COVID and the insanity of COVID. So there's that book. But the book I was thinking of was Johann Harry's book called Connection. Johann Harry, H-A-R-I, Connections. He tells a very personal story of his own journey through depression, anxiety, search for a cure, starts with medication. Guess what? You'll be shocked to hear something here. Just cover your ears and close your eyes. The medication didn't work. Anyway, he went on a journey, literally, traveled around the world, talked to people, and his conclusion, one of his conclusions anyway, was that the greatest way to health was to get involved in a local group that's putting right something that's got nothing to do with you. In other words, get over yourself and get involved in something that really matters. Maybe it matters to you. All of which really could be summed up in the simple phrase that I use, which is take the problem to the place or person to whom it belongs. Which in this time of remembering and celebrating Wellington is exactly what so many of you beautiful listeners did and so many of us were involved in. And how do Kiwis work together and how do we show the rest of the world the way forward? Well, we're all brothers and sisters. We all reach out and put our arms around each other's shoulders and we stand together. We're all victims, whether you were vaccinated or unvaccinated. We're all victims of the same tyrannical government, the lies of the media, the corruption of the judges, the corruption of the police. What we need to do is to walk arm in arm down the street together, demanding truth and justice. But the most important thing in all of that, rather like St. Paul said, is that we must have love. No matter what rage burns inside of us, no matter what hurt we carry, what wounds we are carrying with us, the only thing that will heal anything is love. So you're listening to Reality Check Radio, and this is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And this has been the second part of my show, which is really me just reflecting on what emerged in the first hour of the program in the session with Matthew. I just want to thank everyone for listening. I do see you and I do hear you. I spend a lot of time around you or around brothers and sisters very much like you. And I only do this to reassure you and to soothe you on this pathway that we're all traveling together. And I'm just one voice. Do not take it as an expert voice. Measure it, weigh it, discard it. But above all, I want to say thank you for listening to me.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.